It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 7th, 2021. This week, we welcome one great guest to the show, someone who has a wide and deep knowledge of the UCI and the Peloton. As you know, there was a lot of controversy in this year's Tour de France about all the incidents, beginning with day one's crash from a spectator leaning into the Peloton and taking out the lead rider, causing the domino effect. And outside the race, there have been numerous discussions among professional fitters about what else might be causing so many riders to crash, from the size of the bikes and the kind of equipment the riders are using, to the levels of skill and a lack of respect that newer riders on the World Tour are bringing to the competition. So I decided to go to the source, and today my guest is Vince Jourdain. Vince was in charge of race operations for the UCI from 2016 until earlier this year, and was the national coach for Canada for 15 years. His duties at the UCI were far-reaching, from the organization of each event to fielding actionable complaints and incidents during an event. Today, with everyone having a video camera in his or her pocket and the wide reach of social media, every race can be fraught with issues that might need adjudicating. It's a big job. So what happens when there's a crash or a motor vehicle gets in the way? What is the process and who decides what is to be done about it? Are riders coming to the world stage too early or without going through the proving grounds of local, state, national, and eventually world tour steps? And then, of course, there is the equipment. What happens when something breaks or there is an equipment failure, and how does the UCI determine what is acceptable? And does the industry place too much pressure on the UCI to accept certain products or product categories? These are all questions I put to Vince, and I think you will not only enjoy this conversation, but learn a lot about how professional racing is done. Hello, Vincent. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me on the show this week. How are you?
Very good. Thanks. And you?
I am well. Thank you. A little warm here today in Cleveland, but you're not far from me, a few hours up north. Are you in Toronto?
I am in Toronto, actually. I'm not leaving here, but I'm here for a track camp. You know, I just got a little contract here for a track session here on the velodrome in Milton, close to Toronto.
Nice. Can you get a little closer to your mic? I think it's a little soft.
Okay. Is it better like that?
I think it is. Okay. So I want to talk about some of the things you've done in the past, but I'd like to know a little bit about you and your work. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the world of cycling.
I was racing myself on the road back in the 80s and beginning of 90s. And I started to coach, you know, like probably or most, like most of the coaches, you know, you started to help your club or your team, and then I got involved and I kind of love it. And because, you know, cycling was my passion, even at that time. And then I went back to school, got a study. I did my degree at the university in physical science, and then started to coach with the provincial team and then with the national team. And then worked with the Cycling Canada about 15 years. I went to Beijing Olympic Games in 2008. And then 2012, you know, after all, more than 15 years of coaching and being, especially being on the road for a long period of time, as you can imagine, you know, like being away from home for several months, I decided to, I needed a break. So, and then I moved, I started to work with the Canadian Olympic Committee for 3 years. So from 2012 to 2016, so I did the Pan Am Games here actually in Toronto. I did the Rio Olympic Games, and then over the summer 2016, Had a little bit of contact with the UCI. They were interested to hire me as race operation manager for the road department. And then we, as you can imagine, it's a big move, you know, moving to Switzerland with the family and everything. I got two children, but one is older. So anyway, he's based in Montreal. But anyway, it's a big move, leaving friends and family. But anyway, so after a couple of weeks of negotiation and talk with them, and I decided to go for it and try it. And then I moved to Switzerland. I started to work with them. I was at Qatar, the World Championship in Qatar in 2016, but I officially started to work with the UCI January 2017 as a manager race operation. So yeah, and then I my contract ends last winter for several reasons. So yeah, there's a little bit of politics in there. Can I say that?
Yeah, of course. This is a podcast. You can say whatever you want.
I love it. Love it. But anyway, so lots of politics, so lots of things going on, and as you can imagine, the pro professional level is it's another thing. It's really, really complicated. There's there's three big families in pro cycling. You have the riders union, the CPA. You have the race organizers. They have an organization as well that's called IGCP. The president of the IGCP actually is Christian Prudhomme, the actual general director of the Tour de France. Of ISO. And then you also have the team association, IGCP. And the team association is very strong as well. Over the last few years, they're more organized, they're more unified together. So, and then on the other, and then you have the UCI, of course. And then, so there's a lot of battle and a lot of discussions going on, and for sure nobody's happy, and so there's a lot of it's very complicated. So there's so many players in the game, so that makes the job sometimes a little bit difficult.
So let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then we're going to ask some questions about some of the work you did at the UCI. We're speaking with Vincent Jourdain. I think I pronounced that correctly.
That's correct.
Yes?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. He's in Toronto at a track camp. We're talking about his background, which clearly goes way back with professional cycling. And now we'll find out what you're going to be doing in the future. But I do want to ask you some questions about the UCI and what kinds of statistics. Race operations included gathering statistics. And there's been a lot of... how should we put that? There's been a lot of mishaps this year, especially at the tour, like day one. Yeah. A whole bunch of riders went down. Tell me about the kind of work that you did with these race operations.
Yeah, so race operation, you know, like everything regards the race itself from the start to the end. So that includes for sure safety. Every organizer, they have... have a cahier des charges. Can I say that? Cahier des charges. It's basically they need to follow regulation in terms of when it's time to set up the finish line, or when it's time to set up the number of vehicles and their duties on the race, and number of motorcycles, who's driving those vehicles. And so there's a bunch of regulation. There's few documents that's been put in place over the last few years, you know, to regulate and make sure that everybody is doing the right thing. So my job was to make sure everybody's doing their job. Race organizers, especially, because yeah, they need to follow a list of things. I was also working really closely with our commissaires, referees. So they're the ones who applied the regulation in the race. So I was working closely with them in a sense, especially to prepare them, because there's a pool of commissaires who works at the pro tour, at the world tour level. So our goal was to really work with those commissaires to make sure they're well prepared. They understand every single little change that we made, because every year there's a little bit of change in every regulations. Okay, sometimes they may decide, okay, we're going to switch a little bit this regulation regarding this and this and this. So we're working with the commissaires just to make sure they're aware about everything and they feel confident to do their job. As you know, I think you've seen as well over the last few years, we introduced the referee video. There's a van. The UCI purchased a van, well equipped, a little bit like soccer or any sport like that. We had to do a lot of teaching, you know, with because we use the actual World Tour commissaires. One of the commissaires is assigned to be the video commissaires, so he's part of the panel who make decision on the race, but he's actually sitting in the van and watching the whole race. So depend as well, some of the races, you know, they only have the feed, let's say from the last 100 kilometer. So it depends, but most of the World Tour race in general, we have the feed from kilometer zero to the end. But anyway, this commissaire is sitting in a van and is watching. He's got all the screen. Sometimes, you know, like in the Tour de France, for example, he's going to have up to 12 or even sometimes more camera. So he's going to have, let's say, two helicopter view, four motorbikes, cameras in the race. You're going to have static cameras as well on the finish line, depending, you know, so at least the commissaire has different angle to see the race. So anyway, so that's one of the aspects. And then also in an aspect of my job, if I go back to my job description, I was also really involved in the World Championship, the Road World Championship, because it's a UCI event. So I was working very closely with the organizing committee, sometimes 2, 3, even 4 years in advance. But I've been there for 5 years. But let's say, for example, 2018, it was in Innsbruck, Austria. So actually, my first day in the job at UCI, I was a visit in Austria for the road course. So because we approved the road course, we work with the organizing committee to make sure everything is all right and they respect their obligation. Yeah, so that's pretty much the scope of my duties with the UCI. That was very wide. I was very busy, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I can. So I guess I have a couple of questions. Yeah. Maybe I'm not understanding. The UCI does not cover absolutely every race that's going on in Europe.
But every UCI race, yes. But I was really focusing on the World Tour races. So mostly the World Tour race. So if you look at the calendar, it's about, if you get the three Grand Tour and all the classics and the 1 week stage race like Tour de Romandie or Paris-Nice or all those races, you know, it's about 40 races, you know, something like that. But you have stage race, but there's 1 day race. But I was really focusing on the World Tour races. But yes, it's true. We have the class one and class two event as well, all around the world. So let's say there's an issue in a class one race in South America, for example, we have to deal with that because it's an official UCI event. If something happened in there, we need to look at it. Of course, on site, we have the commissaires, the UCI commissaires, they're assigned to the event. They're the one who, you know, manage the event in terms of regulation. But if something happened, whatever, they're going to contact us and in the office. And then, you know, as you know, and over the last few years, you know, we had a little bit of issue or accident. And also, I think there's many, many, many things comes in play. Is let's say, for example, the social media is also is a big factor now. I would say 10 years ago, I mean, you got a UCI race somewhere, a class one race somewhere in East Europe or South America or in the United States or whatever. And then there was no camera. Nobody has a phone to film the race or something like that. So, yes, maybe we had incidents in the race, but we didn't know. Or we knew it, but way after that. But now the social media effect is everybody has a phone now. everybody's on the side of the road. Everybody's watching the race on their, or sometimes they even follow the race, you know, through a different website, whatever. And now everybody's looking at the race. So everybody's like, you got millions of spies who are looking at the race, and everything's something going on. It's become like a major issue. I'm not saying it's not important, but I mean, like every single issue or every single incident comes. It's sometimes it goes sometimes out of proportion, because sometimes, you know, like, okay, in fact, something happened, but it's minor, but it's sometimes it go out of proportion because for whatever reason, you know, people are, oh, okay, this is not good.
That brings up a question for me about how you determine what is important. Your commissaires are the ones who make the final decision, or maybe somebody higher even than them. You know, just somebody standing on the street corner. Now, of course, we know that that kind of video has played into a lot of things, like Black Lives Matter here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, George Floyd's death would never have done what it did if it hadn't been for some 17-year-old girl. But we're talking bike racing here. You know, we're not talking somebody being stepped on for 8 minutes. So I'm wondering how you make that determination as to what would... You know, let me ask the question differently then. What do you do when an incident happens? So what are you looking for, and then how do you work with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. But basically, when an incident happened in a race, you know, and the riders who are involved get injured or something like that. Anyway, there's a damage, there's a problem. Then first thing we do an investigation. So the first people who got contact is going to be our commissaires, obviously, because they're on site. So we're talking with the chief commissaires, the UCI commissaires who's assigned to the race. So we do first thing we do, talking with them. So it's a phone call. We're going to an investigation. They're going to send us a report as well, a well-report detail with all the step, what happened exactly. And then, of course, we're going to go further. Again, the organizer, we're going to talk with the race director of the event as well, just to see exactly what happened, because it could be an incident with a vehicle involved in the incident. It could be a motorbike, like we have seen it too much. There was vehicle involved in a crash or something like that, or a motorbike or something like that. So we're going to talk with the race director. So basically we do an investigation. We're trying to talk with every people involved in the incidents, the riders themselves, the drivers, everybody who's got involved in the incidents. And then we're at the sport department where I was, we're going to make recommendation. Okay. If it's severe enough, we're going to suggest that this case will be bring to the, there's a disciplinary commission at UCI. So, okay, if there's a rider injured and we believe, and we found out after the investigation that it's because, for example, a vehicle driver was really not paying attention to what he's doing. Normally it should be a UCI license. You need to have a UCI license to drive a vehicle. Then we will recommend this case will go to the disciplinary commission. Then we have that this is like a court, basically an independent court, you know, outside of the UCI. There's a judge, and this case will be sent to this disciplinary commission. Like if you look at the, you know, over the last few years, there were few cases has been brought to the disciplinary commission, and then a judge will determine. Generally, they're gonna look every report. They're going to hear all parties involved, and the judge will make a decision. And sometimes they may say, you know, whatever happened, you know, they may say, okay, this driver or this rider is going to have a 6-month suspension. For example, the Tour of Poland last year incidents with the two sprinters, Jakobsen and Groenewegen, remember? The terrible accident at the finish of stage one. This case has been brought to the disciplinary commission, and Groenewegen get a suspension of 9 months. I think he just got back racing in June or in May this year. So that's an example of this is the process, you know, that generally the step-by-step process has been followed at UCI. As you can imagine, sometimes, you know, it's pretty quiet, but sometimes in the heart of the season, you know, when you have several World Tour races going on, plus all the other UCI race, you know, class one and class two, men and women. Sometimes if you have like five or six incidents happening in the same time, I've seen before I left, I've seen our legal department working with the sport department on up to 15 cases sometimes. That's a lot of discussion, a lot of paperwork. Sometimes those cases doesn't lead necessarily to a disciplinary commission, but we have to do the work anyway, because we have to do the investigation to make sure everybody's has been heard. What's going on? Okay, is it severe enough? Do we need to bring this disciplinary commission? Do we need to bring these cases to the disciplinary commission, or yes or no? But as you can imagine, that's a lot of work.
So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Vincent Jourdain some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. Back on The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm Diane Jenks. We are speaking with Vincent Jourdain. He was the grand poobah of operations for the UCI for a sports director for 5 years. And what a fascinating conversation, but what an interesting series of things you have to go through before you make a determination on something. So while these incidents are happening, and we saw an awful lot, we just saw something at the Olympics that scared the you know what out of me. A handlebar broke off during a track event, an Australian's bar. So I know you kept statistics. What did you do, and what kinds of statistics do you have, and how do you use them?
Yes, we basically that was based on the incidents. So the statistic we had was based on every incident that's happening. So it's going to be like a sprint crash, or it's going to be a vehicle. Sometimes we were trying to keep listing as well the vehicles, because there was, you know, like over the last few years, I think it's personally, I feel like there was a lot of improvement made it. Because we apply, a stronger regulation, and we now the drivers are required to follow a course as well. So I think there's a better job because it's not easy, as you can imagine, driving a vehicle in a bike race. You know, sometimes I'm amazed by the fact that there's not so much incidents happening. Because, you know, like when you're mixing cyclists and vehicles in a race in a bubble on small road at high speed, it's fascinating. There's no more incidents. But anyway, in terms of statistic, we're keeping in tracks, you know, the number of vehicles incidents, just to have an idea what's going on. And we're keeping tracking as well who's driving these vehicles, because we have the list of every organizer need to submit the list of drivers. Of their vehicles in the race. In terms of incidents regarding equipment, I had colleagues, and now this department is overseen by the former pro rider from Australia, Michael Rogers. I don't know if you remember Michael Rogers. He was also working with one of the World Tour team over the last few years, but now he's working with the UCI. He's head of the equipment. So basically, because every companies they need to submit their every time there's a new frame, new wheel, or a new part of a new component of equipment, they need to submit this equipment for to the UCI for approval. because it needs to be on the list. Like the wheels, for example, there's a list of wheels, you know, available on the UCI website. So if a company wants to launch a new sets of wheel, a new pair of wheel for road, even for track, they need to submit this wheels for test and improvement by the UCI. So and Michael and his team, they also try to track incidents regarding because of the equipment. If there's an equipment failure, like you mentioned, just to mention on the track, in Tokyo, of course they're gonna do some investigation with the National Federation as well. So what happened exactly? What type of equipment? Is it due to just a human mistake, or maybe just equipment? Because equipment is they're trying to be as light as possible, as rigid as possible, or as aerodynamic as possible. But sometimes there's a limit, and sometimes the limit there. It's a very, even on the road as well. You know, like bikes are lighter, much more lighter than it was, but with this brake and everything. So has nothing to do with 15 years ago now. So and they go faster with lighter bikes and this brake. So.
Right, exactly. So that brings me to the riders themselves. And there are a lot of young riders right now, which is a good thing. It means the sport is growing and expanding with some new talent. Yeah. But do you think there is, and this is kind of one of those, I hate to ask that question, do you think they're as well-trained? Do you think that they have skills that can match this equipment and match the older riders and match these routes that are so technical and so difficult?
Yeah, I don't have any like data in terms of, the step for a young rider to go up to the World Tour level. But we've seen over the last few years, I think the pathway is a little bit different. If I go back, let's say 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, you started like in the young categories and then you were going step by step. And then going national team and then doing pro, but maybe at the third with the third team, and then eventually go with the top teams. But sometime now we see more often young riders coming to the World Tour level without necessarily the background of sometimes they may come from another sport, or they coming like for that whatever reason they've been detected. Oh, this guy has got an engine. He's 18 years old and he's pushing a lot of watts. Okay, let's put him on the bike. But he never really through the step by step, from club racing, local racing, provincial level, national level, and things like that, like in the past. So yes, we do have some riders actually that they don't necessarily have the background. Also, there's many riders coming from all different from part of the world right now that they don't necessarily have the background in terms of for youngs racing, for kids, for racing for kids. So they don't necessarily have the experience. I would say even for the Canadians, I've been working for Cycling Canada for 15 years. I always said that it's still a challenge for young, I would say Americans is the same as well. Going to Europe and race European race with Europeans, it's totally a different story. Roads are way smaller, narrow. You're going to put like 150 riders on a small road, up and down, really fast. It has nothing to do with the watts. You need to get the skills to be in the front. You need to be really confident. So it's very easy. So it's very technical. So if you're not able to go up in the front, you will never be a bike pro rider in Europe. So, and has nothing to do with your fitness and your capabilities, in terms of physical abilities. I've seen young riders, coming to the tour level, World Tour level, without this experience, racing. And also, I heard also from riders, I heard it from different riders, a little bit older, or the ones that they went through the step, very young in a club, and they've done their class. And I heard that from them that there's a lack of respect as well in the peloton. So, I mean, like, because for sure, the guy who has a one-year contract in a World Tour team, he's going to do everything he has to do, you know, to make his team happy. Because what he wants is to get another shot, you know, and race next year in the team. So it's very, very tough. Very tough, you know, and there's a little bit of lack of respect. I would say maybe a lack of respect, but also a higher competition. And also what I heard from the riders is like, and maybe in the past few years ago, there was a lot of racers, even World Tour races, during the year that every race is tough, but there were some races that was for more preparation. I mean, like, for example, Tour de Romandie, Tour de Dauphiné Libéré, or Tour de Suisse in June. We all know that those races are in preparation for the Giro, for the Tour de France, for example. Or there's a few classic before Tour of Flanders. It's a preparation, it's a prep for Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix. But now every race is important because the teams are chasing the points. So they put a lot of pressure on the riders. So young riders, as I said, we'll go back. The young riders, he's got a one-year contract. And the guy, the sport director says, look, we need to win this race. We need the point. You're gonna do everything to bring the sprinters up to the front. So this kid, what do you think he's going to do? He's going to do everything he can to bring the sprinters to the front. So he's going to take chance. Not necessarily. Sometimes, yes, he could. He's going to do mistake. And he's going to push, right? They're going to push themselves. I spoke with some riders. They say, Vince, look, there's no more easy races. All the races is like war. They go in the start line and they go as fast as they can, even from January to October. So there's no easy races now. It's not easy. You look at the speed, it's just incredible.
Yes.
So if you put this mix, you know, you put those factor, lack of skill sometimes, lack of respect, battle for points, small road. It's a mix for mistake. It's a mix for sure. It's going to result to an incident. And if you look at the Tour de France, it's even worse because the Tour de France is the Olympic Games for cycling. So for 3 weeks, you got the 20 best team in the world with the 8 best guy in each team. And all you got probably, I'd say half of those teams, they're going for the stages with the sprinters. And the other half is they have GC riders. But everybody wants to be in the front. But sometimes the road is just like six meter wide and sometimes not even. So mathematically, it's just impossible. So if you put the best rider in the world, they all want to be in the front. The result at the end is we're going to have crashes. If you look over the last, 10 years, the first week, it's always a nightmare. So because there's so much tension, there's so much stress in the peloton, and you got, unfortunately, we lost GC riders the first week, like this year again, because of crashes. And we saw it in the Giro as well, but I would say Giro, maybe a little bit less because Tour de France, you know, like the teams that their sponsors, their funding is like the sponsors basically is there for the tour. Yes, he cares about Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders for sure, but the most important race for the sponsors is the tour. You know, he's probably said, I would say 75-70% of their the reason why he sponsor a team is because the tour. So that there's so much pressure around the Tour de France itself. It's just the first week is just there's so much pressure. It's just a nightmare.
So interesting and yet kind of scary. So I have a couple of questions, and I don't know if they're answerable on this end. And that has to do with not just the equipment and the rider, but the rider on the equipment. There has been some conversation about getting bikes smaller and smaller and smaller, meaning that you are changing the position of the rider on the bike, since I come from a fitting background, and that's sort of what I look at. And so you have the front end loaded and the back end unloaded in some of these. And certainly when we build bikes, you know, we build them for this geometry that fits the rider, but are these bikes too small? Are they looking for trouble when they fit the way they are?
I don't have the answer, but probably in some cases. We've seen some incidents over the last few years that, okay, we need to, I think we should pay attention to that for sure. I think there should be a little bit more a study around that. Because yes, I don't have the answer, but I think, yes, we should pay attention to a little bit more about that. Just looking at the weight of the bike, the fork, we've seen like incidents with fork. Like, I don't know if you remember, like, what's his name, the Slovenian riders during the Giro, the guy who won the two stages during the Tour de France. What's his name? He's riding with Bahrain, Merida. Moric. I don't know if you've seen his crash during the Giro, but he was going downhill and his fork just snapped. And he went over the bar. Like, he could kill himself.
Right.
Yeah, but, hopefully, you know, he was able to, you know, he stopped racing for sure at that time, but he was able to come back. But it could have been worse. We've seen Ryder now, because now they're going way faster and on the flat, downhills. Downhills is just crazy sometimes.
The speed they go.
And sometimes they're going to push their limit in every corner. And sometimes they're way too fast. And then I feel like sometimes, and with the disc brake, I'm just wondering, you know, like, because it changed a little bit. The disc brakes are good. But, I mean, I tested, you know, myself, I'm riding a mountain bike and a road bike with disc brake now, but I mean, it's totally a different before with the normal brake. You had to start braking a little bit before the corner, let's say. With the disc brake, you can wait a little bit longer. So that means you're gonna go from, let's say, I don't know, 80K an hour in a downhill, and you're gonna start braking very late before the corner, and you're gonna start from 80 to, I don't know, 50K an hour in a short period of time. So that means you're jumping in the brake. Yes, and also I'm just wondering about the pressure on the fork as well, because if we have lighter brake and you got a big guy as well on the bike, and as you said, probably if the bike is too small, all those reasons, you know, could lead to something dramatic, I think. But I don't have the answer, as I said, but I'm sure we've got to pay attention to that for sure.
Let's take another short break, and when we return, we'll pick up the conversation with Vince Jourdain. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Are back, and before we went to break, we were talking with Vince Jourdain about brakes, or brakes, disc brakes, and forks braking. Building bikes for disc brakes, you have to overbuild the fork, overbuild the front end, but you also mentioned watts, and when all you're looking at is putting out power, then maybe those skills of going downhill, because you may not even need to be braking that hard and that late, you know, if your skills are better. And I don't know. All I know is this disc brake thing is pretty controversial. And so that brings me to another question about how the UCI decides to accept or reject a product or even a category like disc brakes. Oh, you're smiling.
I don't know what to say. you know what, it's like anything, you know, there's for sure. I mean, this break to me, I think like the pressure from the industry is so high, you know. It was, you know, they wanted to introduce this break, you know, since a long time on the market. And for them, for sure, if I say a name like Shimano, for example, they really need to have pro riders with disc brake in the peloton, because they want to sell more disc brake on the market. So at the end of the day, it's become very political. There was a lot of study, you know. I know there was a process over the last few years. I was not involved necessarily because, as I said, I had my colleagues with the equipment. They were overseeing this question of the disc brake. But there was a lot of discussion. There was a commission as well in charge of. Yeah, there's a UCI commission in charge of materials. So they look at the materials, and those people in the commissions come. You can have their names. You know, if you go on the UCI website, there's several commissions for road, track, and everything, including materials. So there's people from different background on this commission, and they make decision at the end. So they make the suggest, they approve the regulation, but of course the regulation needs to be approved ultimately by the managing committee at the UCI. So every time there's a regulation, we write the regulation, the proposal. Let's say I was working closely with the road commission. Sometimes they say we're going to work on a regulation about the feed zone, for example. We're going to write something the road commission will approve. And then after that, the next step, it goes to the management committee to approve finally the regulation before it's been published. So that's the step-by-step process. So in terms for the disc brake, it has been over a period of like 2, 3, 4 years, you know, where there was a lot of discussion from the moment they introduced the disc brake. And I'm sure the regulation will evolve as well. It's going to change over the next few years as well, because of course, they will improve the product as well. The size. I know there was a lot. There's still a lot. It's funny because we stopped talking about that, but remember there was some incidents during crashes
with the rotor.
Yeah, with the rotor, because some of the riders get caught.
Right.
And there was a lot of discussion regarding about putting a kind of a protection around the rotor. But I think that was it. I haven't heard anything about that, but after that, but I'm surprised because there's no longer protection. There's no more protection. So if for sure, when there's a crash going on, we still have some incidents with the rotor. Because it's like a knife.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my hope is that we see some variety and some sanity coming back, because it's just getting more and more exotic.
Yeah.
And it's all, you know, it can't be all about equipment. It really has to be about the skill of the rider, in my opinion. Last thing I want to talk about is what you think needs to change to improve the safety of cycling. On the pro level, on the racing level, competition level,
world tour level, I think there's several things. Of course, they need, as I said earlier at the beginning of our discussion, you know, there's three big family: the riders, the organizers, and the teams, and then you get the right. UCIs. So there's a lack of communication and a lack of cohesion between all of those people. So that's one thing. It takes a better collaboration between all the parties. Yes, of course, my former employer could have a different opinion on me right now, but I think there's place for improvement right now. That would make a difference because, you know, if they talk each other, I feel like the rider, especially the Riders Association, the CPA, and even amongst the rider themselves, They're not even happy about their own association. Sometimes if you look at some riders, they speak after an event or something like that. They're gonna say, "Our riders unions they're not doing their job," or blah blah blah. So I feel like the riders union is not working well together. They're not unified. They're not strong enough. So they need to have the right people in place. I'm not saying they don't have the right people in place, but I personally, for the person I deal with over the last 5 years, they should know better what they're doing, and they should be a better spokesperson, and they should battle a little bit more for their rider. Because at the end of the day, who's taking chance? Who's taking risk? Riders. So the teams, they won't necessarily battle for them. Yes, they are paying their salary, but I mean, who's in a better place to defend the riders? To me, I think it's the rider union. So I think there should be a better association. They need to be stronger because they're not strong enough. And if they're not strong enough, for sure, one of the parties will take advantage of that. So as I said, it's become political. That's one thing. I know they need. When I was there, we started to work as well. They have a document of obligation for the organizers. The organizers, they need to. They have a series of obligations that they need to put in place when they organize a world tour event. This document, when I was there, I think I did like at least three or four updates on the document with improvement. So there's more obligation, and since 3 years as well, there's sanctions as well. So there's a table of sanction that's been put in place to sanction organizer that they don't do their job. It's totally new. It was not existing before. Only riders and probably sport director were able to get a sanction if they do a mistake in the race. But now since 2 years, the organizer, they also, if they do a failure, they're going to face a sanction. And we already last year, I don't know if you remember, Bing Bang Tour in Europe has received a sanction in terms of dollars. And also they had to pay to get advice and things like that. In this case, it's a little bit better. I would say it would take as well a little bit more consistencies in terms of UCI giving a little bit more sanction to the organizer to make sure that every organizer do their best and they follow the obligation. Because sometimes, you know, if they don't feel, okay, I'm not going to do this or this because it's way too much money. No, you need to follow the obligation. Otherwise, you can face a sanction and things like that. There's other things to do for sure. There's a lot of things to do. But I think if you have a stronger union for the riders and also more sanctions to the organizer, I think it's the right direction at least. For sure, technically also, they need to look at the innovation. When I was there and now they've been using it for 2-3 years, there's a company from Norway. I don't know if you've seen it. They're using it in the Tour de France as well. We did use it at the World Championship. It's a big signage. It's like lights. I don't know if you've seen lights. Instead of using normal signage on the road, it's like, how do you call that? The lights, you know, I'm looking for the word.
Signals? Traffic signals?
Kind of as traffic signals, but specifically made it for road cycling. And it's super high, super wide. And so generally, they're going to use those signals for the last 30, 40 kilometers because sometimes the motorbike marshal are not able to pass the peloton at the end of the race to go in front and make sure the race is safe and do marshal on every corner. So we're going to use those signals on this specific corner. Okay, let's say there's a big roundabout and there's a left turn and we're about 5K to go. So they're going to put that this signage. And this signage as well makes sounds. So the riders, they know exactly. It's very loud. So they can hear. So they can see it. And, so at least they know, okay, we're going, it's going to get narrow and we're going to go left. So that's innovation. And this is really good. I don't know if you've seen as well. It's a company from Belgium. They tested during the Tour of Flanders this year, a new fence, a new barriers for the finish. Because we had this issue last year during the Tour of Poland. Because if you get a crash at high speed, you need to make sure you have the right materials. For sure, there's a lot of improvements needs to be made on this side. But this company in Belgium came with a good product. It's kind of a plastic barriers. They're a little bit higher. And you put water into it. So that makes the weight. And if the riders hit the barriers, you know, they just slide on it. They're not going to go. There's no way they can go through it. So anyway, it's a better barriers specifically made for cycling. But as you can imagine, that's cost a lot of money. So
sure.
So at the end of the day, it's always like a challenge because some organizer can afford for that. Some don't. So this is where maybe the UCI will need to step in and make an agreement with this company. Probably, I don't know, necessarily maybe buy a bunch of those buyers and maybe those buyers like Formula One, you know, go from one race to another with the same material. They need to have a better protocol. The protocol need to be a little bit more strict in terms of racing. what's going on, what needs to be put in place for the finish, what needs to be done, you know, for the drivers. I mean, all those information is in place, but sometimes what is missing is just to make sure every organizer has a good sport direct, a good race director, because sometimes you're going to have like a, it's weird because I assume, you know, as a North American going in Europe, I assume that everybody knows bike racing over there than better than us, whatever reason. Anyway, I was believing in that, but you, I was going to a big bike race, you know, world tour races. And sometimes there's so many people that there are about 200 people working in the race, but there's no one who are necessarily who really know exactly bike racing. They know bike racing, but I mean, you need to have like a strong race director who owns the race, who knows exactly the race operation. Okay, what exactly is going to happen? What needs to be done? And okay, there's this section is really critical. What needs to be done? Or the feed zone is very critical. Okay, what need to be put in place? So you need to have a strong cycling people in every organization, but sometimes it's missing. I know when I was there, I addressed this issue. I said, we need to make sure we have a safety manager and a good and a strong race director in every organization. And these people, we need to work with them. Make sure if they need courses, if they need whatever thing you need, we need to work with them to make sure their race is getting better. So that's pretty much the the scope of the.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big scope. So the last thing is, if you're not there anymore, what are you doing?
Actually, I'm looking for a job. I've been in, you know, I just got back, as I said earlier, I just got back in Canada since 2 months now.
Yeah.
So it's very recent. I'm not rushed to take a full-time position right now. My goal is like, now I'm 51, so I've been in the sport and cycling as well for a very long time. I'm still involved with my former employee in Canada, the Canadian Olympic Committee, but as you can imagine, they're pretty busy at the moment with this competition going on. So anyway, I'm in contact with them. There's maybe an opportunity with them a little bit later in the fall. I'm also talking with the cycling people here, obviously. As I said, I'm in Toronto for a cycling camp, just here to help, because some people, they say, can you help out this week? So I said, yes, I don't have anything to do anyway. So so we'll see. I hope to stay in the world of sport for sure, because that's my life. I love it. That's my passion.
I know. It like takes hold of you and doesn't let go.
Exactly. And that's all I know as well. You know, I've always been involved in sport and always been in cycling. So I don't see myself, you know, sitting in the office. I'm not going to say it's bad, but I mean, I want to bring something positive to somewhere where people will be happy to work with me and I will be happy to work with them. That's my goal. If I can be happy with what I'm doing, and if the people I work with are happy as well, that's my goal. I'm going to be happy as well.
Well, I'm happy to have been able to speak with you. We've been speaking with Vincent Jourdain. He was the race operations director for the UCI for 5 years. He's been in the Canadian team coach?
Yeah, head coach
for 15 years?
15 years, yeah.
Yeah. So I it's just been a delightful conversation, and I appreciate all of your insight. I think my listeners are going to find it very interesting, and I really thank you for taking time to talk with me.
That was my pleasure, Diane.
All right. You take care.
Yeah, you too.
My thanks to Vince Jourdain for sharing his expertise about the inner workings of the UCI and some of his thoughts on what might help to improve the organization, keep the riders safer, and move that needle forward toward better racing across the world. Next week, I talk with Eldon Nelson, Mr. Leadville himself. The Leadville 100 has had a lot of changes in the past year, and I wanted to catch up with what those changes are and what Eldon sees as the future of events such as Leadville and Unbound. We'll have more to talk about next week, too. Before we go, I'd like to give a big shout-out to Johnny Velo Bikes in Clintonville, Ohio. The shop was one of only 8 in the U.S. to earn a platinum rating by the NBDA. So, of course, my thanks to you for listening to the show, and I hope you'll take a moment to rate it on your favorite podcast app.
You can always join one of the many conversations that are taking place on our Facebook page each day and follow us on Instagram at Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.